This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 100 years ago, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation opened in New York City. The first ever feature-length film, it was also the first movie to be screened at the White House and continues to top critics' lists of the all-time greatest movies. The Birth of a Nation depicted the Civil War and early Reconstruction, featuring white actors in blackface portraying feeble-minded or rapacious slaves, and culminating with masked Klansmen galloping in to save the South from those menacing Negroes. It was America's first blockbuster, setting off a resurgence of savage Klan activity, presenting a whitewashed version of racism and stoking reverence for the noble Southern cause that had been trounced just 50 years before its release. With the debate over the meaning and symbolism of the Confederate flag still flapping in the background, Josh Zeitz wrote for Politico about The Birth of a Nation and the film's enduring influence on American racism and politics. And Josh Zeitz, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
First, a little on the film and the story that it tells.
Certainly. So, Birth of a Nation was based on a trilogy of novels that were published in the early 20th century. It was specifically predicated on one of those novels called The Klansman, which sought to retell the story of Reconstruction through the eyes of the vanquished South, and it made villains out of radical Republicans, particularly Thaddeus Stevens, who had been the House Republican leader and leader of the radical faction of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives during the Civil War and Reconstruction. And it was an unabashedly kind of racist novel and film that blamed the chaos and violence of Reconstruction on radicals who presumably attempted to impose black equality on the South in too quick a fashion, rather than on white Southerners who attempted to overthrow essentially the gains of the Civil War through violent means.
So why, given that extreme depiction of racism, is it still considered one of the greatest films ever made?
Well, from a purely aesthetic point of view, it was groundbreaking. The filmmaker, David Wark Griffith, was one of the pioneers of American film. And at the time, it was, I believe, the longest film that had ever been made. It was certainly the first biopic, and it actually pioneered some of the early innovations in filmmaking. For instance, the pin needle kind of flashback, as well as a number of other things that film historians consider to be, you know, tremendous breakthroughs.
I wonder how viewers, you know, I'm just trying to imagine 100 years ago, maybe the first film that they've ever watched, how powerful those images must have been. How did people react?
Oh, I mean, it was Woodrow Wilson allegedly said that it was like writing history with lightning, although it's hard to verify that he ever said that. But it was, in its time, a tremendously exciting event. It was a roughly three-hour film with all the great actors of the day, including Lillian Gish, who went on to have a storied career in Hollywood. And it was replete with historical reenactments of great moments and stirring battle scenes. It used hundreds and hundreds of actors. It was a tremendous event, and unfortunately it had a profound impact on how people popularly remembered the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Well, you write that the film created the modern and enduring cult of the noble cause. So what did that mean for the nation? Now, this was just 50 years after the decimation of the Civil War.
Sure. Think of it. This is 50 years after the end of the Civil War, and it's only about 24 years before Gone with the Wind. The film created an enduring sense that the antebellum South had been a marvelous and harmonious society in which slaves and their owners or masters got along perfectly well, in which there was a symmetry of interest, and that the war disrupted this, and that it had been foisted on the South and on the North unwittingly by a group of radical and profane congressmen, Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens, who were seeking to impose a vengeful military rule on the South, and who also sought to impose black equality when it had no place in its time. The film's entire premise was that African Americans, that their proper place, that the place they were congenitally fit for, was the plantation and a position of subservience, that the moment they were freed from their bonds of servitude, they became violent, drunk, power-hungry, and dangerous. And certainly you'll see a lot of imagery in the film that suggests that when freed from their natural state of servitude, black men pose a sexual and violent threat to white women. So all of this is sort of the, you know, it presumes that the Confederacy was the good society, and that all of the turmoil that followed, and certainly all of the racial turmoil that followed from the Civil War and Reconstruction, owed its roots to the Radical Republicans rather than to a system of black servitude and white violence.
So what kind of influence did that have on the ground in the real world, both in politics and racism as it was understood in America?
Remember, this is the high tide of Jim Crow. There had been a tremendous reaction to the brief period of racial liberalism that you saw during the Civil War era and Reconstruction era. This is the high tide of scientific racism, the high tide of Jim Crow. There were two or three African Americans being lynched in the South every week in this period. And on a practical level, it had, you know, a wide-ranging effect in searing into public consciousness a message that was also being delivered in lots of other media through, you know, academic historians and academic scientists were emblazing this kind of sense of scientific racism and skewed history at some of the greatest universities in the land. Columbia University's William Dunning, you know, was the leading scholar of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and he gave a scholarly gloss to just this interpretation. On a very fundamental level, it was roughly around the time that the film was playing in Atlanta in November 1915 that a group of Georgians decided that it was tremendously inspirational, and they founded the second incarnation of the Ku Klux Klan, having been stirred to action by some of the battle scenes and the Klan scenes in the movie. And the Ku Klux Klan went on to have an enormous political sway throughout the country, particularly in the South and Midwest, well into the mid-1920s.
We're talking with Josh Zeitz, who wrote an article for Politico about how an infamous movie, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, revived the Confederacy. Well, that, Josh, was the headline for your story anyway. I know you don't write the headlines, but a film revived the Confederacy? Can we really draw a line from that movie to the cause?
Sure. I think the headline, of course, as you noted, I didn't write it, but the headline, I think, is more suggestive than literally accurate. What the film did was it revived the myth of the Confederacy or of the lost cause. It fed a larger cultural and academic sensibility that viewed the Confederacy as a benign society, that viewed the old pre-Civil War South as a benign society in which there was a mutuality and a commonality of interests between African-American slaves and white slave owners. And according to that mythology, the sort of beautiful world that we would later come to know through films like Gone with the Wind, which was really a second-generation follower to Birth of a Nation, that beautiful world was disrupted by the Civil War and then by Reconstruction. And in point of fact, we now know that the pre-Civil War South was one that was largely governed by violence against African Americans who were placed in a position of forced labor. There was nothing particularly wonderful about that world, but films like Birth of a Nation helped to revive the sort of the idea that there was a lost cause that might have at one point or another been realized.
Well, I want to dig into that a little. I mean, certainly the film had a tremendous influence on culture, but it's also was made and set against a backdrop of a 20th century narrative of the Civil War having been about states' rights or about trade. You argue differently.
That's right. In the early 20th century, academic historians and popular writers and filmmakers and novelists struggled to locate the causes of the Civil War everywhere but in the most obvious place. So there was one school of thought that claimed that the Civil War had actually been about competing economic interests between an industrial North and an agrarian South. An offshoot of that held that it was really about the tariff, about a pro-tariff North going to war with a anti-tariff South. There were still others who claimed, as late as into the 1940s and 50s, that while slavery had been an underlying cause of the war, slavery had always been a major dividing issue between the North and South, and that generations of politicians had managed to kind of maintain a unity and status quo, and that they had managed that issue until the 1850s, when you had a so-called bungling generation of politicians on both sides, both North and South, abolitionists and fire eaters, who excited popular passions for political gain and then somehow lost control of that debate. That was the theory, at least well into the 1950s. I think historians since the modern civil rights era have come to realize that they should take the primary sources from that era at face value, and that slavery was very much the driving force behind the war. For many Northerners, that was not just about, or it wasn't even about, a commitment to black equality or black freedom. It also was a sense in the 1850s that slavery was a bad social and economic and political system that was retarding the progress, the material progress of the South. And for many Southerners, particularly those who did not own slaves, there was still a material investment in slavery, which was it was a system that placed all white people on a plane of equality, no matter what their economic circumstances were. And so when you remove that, you were, in effect, opening up a much wider array of inequality between different white people. So I think we have a much more sophisticated understanding of how slavery created the war. And it's not as clean cut as we once thought it was.
But looking at it as an historic document, you know, both as a piece of filmmaking and as emblematic of a time, with its scenes of idyllic antebellum life and these noble Confederates, how does your reviewing of this film inform this continued debate that we have now over the meaning of the Confederate flag, for example, and that kind of symbolism of the Confederacy?
Well, it's a really striking thing. I mean, Birth of a Nation was made 50 years after the close of the Civil War. It literally was, you know, the war ended in 1865 and the film premiered in early 1915. And, you know, that's 100 years ago. As a historian, I'm not at all surprised to see that during the high watermark of the Jim Crow era, an era in which scientific racism, popular racism, cultural racism, which was in part driven by a reaction to the new immigration wave that Americans were sustaining, but also as well the aftermath of Reconstruction, the emergence of modern science, all of these things fed Jim Crow. It's not surprising to me that a Southern filmmaker would receive widespread accolades for his reinterpretation and reimagination of the Confederacy and the antebellum South. What's surprising to me is that 100 years after that, and 150 years after the war has ended, we still are having a debate about the propriety of flying the Confederate flag. And I'm not just talking about private citizens flying it. I'm talking about states sanctioning it and flying it outside of their state houses. It's a remarkable thing that we still have this discussion 150 years after the war and 100 years after the movie.
Birth of the Nation is at the top or near the top of several lists I've seen of the top 100 films of all time. So it is really held up as this document of filmmaking. But now that we are looking at symbolism differently and this glorification of the Old South differently, can we still look at it purely as a piece of filmmaking rather than a kind of piece of propaganda that it essentially represents?
I think you have to look at it as all of those things, and I think it always has been. In its day, it was most certainly a piece of historical propaganda, but it was also a tremendously innovative piece of film, which was at the time, a format that was in its infancy. And today, I think film historians should look at D.W. Griffith's work because he was such a pioneer of the industry and of the art that we came to know as filmmaking. There's no way to separate him from the history of American film or even film writ large globally. That having been said, it remains a piece of historical and cultural propaganda that is tremendously relevant to any discussion about historical memory. So you don't want to remove it from the shelf, you don't want to remove it from the classroom, but you do want to look at it with a very critical eye from all vantage points and understand why it was important in its time, how it contributed to the development of American film, and also understand how it contributed in a lasting way to a grossly distorted understanding of American history.
Well, Josh, thank you for the history lesson today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Josh Seitz is an historian, Politico magazine contributor, and author of Lincoln's Boys. Today, South Carolina legislators are debating whether to remove the Confederate flag from the state capitol. Now, we will have updates on that debate and a link to read Josh's article, How an Infamous Movie Revived the Confederacy. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Back in 2011, Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford co-starred in the film Cowboys and Aliens, a summer blockbuster that took two completely different genres and smashed them together. But maybe the alien invasion flick and the Cowboys and Indians trope are not so far apart after all. Both involve uninvited visitors to a new world, the seizing and occupation of land, and a heavy loss of human life. When Cowboys and Aliens first came out, producer Eric Molinsky looked at the alien invasion narrative from a Native American perspective and brought us this story.
When Leanne Howe watches movies about alien invasions, all she can think about is the arrival of white men to North America.
Remember these aliens that come in, they want to take our space, they want to use our minerals, or they just want to wipe us out and farm other kinds of alien things.
Howe is a member of the Choctaw Nation, and she's a professor of Native American studies.
And notice what happens to the aliens. They get kicked up, beat up, and driven off, or, oh, here's the other one. Sometimes they get sick with a cold, and all of them die.
You know, I'm seeing it through different eyes. A lot of people look at the invasion movies, and they think of, you know, communism or the great threats from Russia. But I'm seeing what happened in this land. I mean, we had a Holocaust here.
As a Native American, Owl Going Back takes these films very personally. He's a writer of science fiction and horror.
You had primitive Native people looking upon these basically god-type men arriving in sailing ships, wearing coats of armor that were shining in the sun to people who didn't have any metals. The Natives have never seen that.
Whether you're watching a movie like Pocahontas or Independence Day, there's always a scene of first contact between the indigenous people and the visitors.
The sky? No. From England.
The land.
To the east.
Do they come in peace? What's their agenda?
Leave. There won't be any leaving till spring.
A moment of awe is shattered by an act of violence.
Gunpowder.
Which would be comparable to the ray guns in War of the Worlds.
We'd be the first to make contact with them.
The humans wave a white flag at the Martians.
Everybody understands when you wave the white flag, you want to be friends.
But the humans still get zapped.
And it reminds me so much of the Sand Creek Massacre, which took place in the Colorado Territory. And the chief stood under an American flag. And not only was he under an American flag, but he also ran up a white flag. And a lot of the people were cut down. And, you know, it didn't help the Native Americans during that massacre, and it certainly didn't help the people in War of the Worlds.
Of course, the big alien movie coming out this summer is Cowboys and Aliens, where cowboys, not Indians, are facing a hostile invasion.
What is that thing?
Why are you asking me?
Because you've shot it.
But playing Indian is nothing new, according to Leanne Howe. She says, look at the Boston Tea Party, when colonists revolted against the British by dressing up as Mohawks.
If you are no longer British, what are you? And so the best way to do that was to dress up and play Indian.
This desire to play Indian, she sees it a lot.
People will come up to you and say, I was an Indian in another life. I'm generally left speechless.
Professor Despina Kakudaki studies science fiction narratives. She takes a more psychological approach to understanding this paradox.
It's hard to be in both positions where you are saying, oh, I see, I am inhabiting the position of the Native Americans here, and that is giving me an insight of the historical experience that they had. If you are them, you're them. You took over their position in terms of the narrative, and it also makes the original victim disappear somehow.
Of course, the humans usually beat back the aliens in the end. But Professor Kakudaki would love to see a movie where neither side wins.
It would have to have lots of meetings. It would have to have a lot of frustrated people who hate each other's guts, but somehow the next day they realize that maybe something is to be gained here, and maybe we talk some more.
Tedious negotiation is not the stuff of a Hollywood blockbuster. Leanne Howe knows that from her own tribe's history.
The French really are the first people that we adopted as Choctaw people, and We negotiate with them over a particular problem for 22 years, and the French have nearly gone mad. And in the end, the Choctaws finally lose all patience and go to war and hang their intestines in trees after we've killed them. It's not great filming.
It's hard to see yourself as the bad guy, no matter what your role would have been in history. Leanne Howe turned the alien invasion genre on its head. She wrote a play about American Indians who build a spaceship and search for a new planet. They end up on Mars. The land is already inhabited by little green men. And amazingly, there's no conflict between the Indians and the Martians.
No, we get married. And so everybody sings and dances, and that's the end of the show. Mm-hmm. So you have a fusion of red and green, like Christmas.
So there's no fighting at all? There's no misunderstandings?
Oh, no. Our diplomacy skills save the day.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When NBC announced that it was canceling Hannibal late last month, fans of the program, or Fannibals, pommeled the network. A Save Hannibal hashtag flourished on Twitter, along with a series of animated GIFs created for mourners on Jiffy. Between the tearful and fire-breathing emoji, Fannibals launched an online petition to relaunch the series on any carrier. NBC, Netflix, AMC, Stars. Viewers who need their fix are indifferent to the source. That's a new phenomenon in the fluid new landscape of on-demand television, where network loyalty is scarce and cancellation no longer means the end. Philip Maciak writes the Dear Television column for the LA Review of Books, and Philip, it's great to have you back with us.
Yeah, great to be back.
So NBC announced cancellation of Hannibal late last month, just barely into the third season. Why? Just not enough numbers?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think as Hannibal has gone along, and I'm saying this just disclaimer as someone who's a little bit behind on Hannibal, so please forgive any inaccuracies. But I think as the more that the show has gone along, the Brian Fuller has been, I think, a little bit more risky and daring in the aesthetic choices. It's a very gory show. It's a very kind of high-minded aesthetic show. And it's a show that is I think, difficult for networks to gin up a lot of interest in.
Brian Fuller is the show creator, showrunner?
Yes.
Now, so the reaction was swift, especially from fans who petitioned NBC and Netflix, interestingly enough, with a campaign on change.org. Any chance that it would get uncancelled?
I think this is an evolving news story. I read just before we started talking today, I think that the main cast members, Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen, have been let out of their contracts. I don't know if that's a sort of final thing or a logistical issue, but it's looking less and less, to me at least, like it's going to get picked up or like they're going to be making new shows. But I know that that Fuller had given a number of interviews where he was very excited to move on to a different format, possibly to Amazon Prime, I think was something that he said, because Amazon Prime is where Hannibal is streaming now.
So a number of viewers have signed a petition, sent it to NBC TV, the network that canceled Hannibal, and Netflix, interestingly enough. Is there any chance that their petition could make a difference?
I think there's a kind of mixed history of things like this happening. I think the most famous example in recent memory was when viewers of Friday Night Lights, which was on the cusp of being canceled, were joined together and sent boxes with light bulbs in them to the executives in charge, urging them to bring Friday Night Lights back, and it really worked. So I don't know if these kinds of fan campaigns have a lot of purchase, but there are certainly a lot of sort of eccentric examples of it that go back a ways. So it's entirely possible that that these sorts of things might increase in number in the future as we see places like Netflix and Hulu picking up shows that get canceled by networks.
So cancellation is no longer cancellation. What are the alternatives? I mean, are there other programs that have been resurrected by popular outcry?
Sure. So a couple of kind of recent examples include Community was picked up by Yahoo, and it continues to be picked up by Yahoo. We saw Arrested Development get resurrected as one of the first the first moves in Netflix's stages of original programming. Things like this are happening both for shows that have been gone for a long time and for shows that get what people perceive to be unfairly canceled and want to have a new life. So there, it's not the end, especially when shows are not owned by networks, but are rather owned by production studios.
Well, I guess this is the new frontier, right? That Yahoo, yeah. Netflix, these are not networks, so they don't have to abide by the same rules. But are there examples of programs really having a new life on these new platforms?
I think that's kind of yet to be seen. I think a lot of people talked about Arrested Development as being as having an opportunity to be riskier or bolder in terms of its storytelling when it went to Netflix. Some people thought that was true. To me, it was a little bit too much, a little bit too baroque in its construction. I mean, the reason people liked Arrested Development in the first place is that it seemed too complicated, too risky, too bold in its storytelling for network TV. And so to say that Resurrected on Netflix could allow it to be even more so, I think to some extent alienated even viewers who liked it. It's interesting, I think, as we move into this and seeing things like even the Mindy Project getting picked up, to what extent do these shows take this opportunity of getting away from networks to essentially do what they already wanted to do? In other words, to do things that they felt that were being censored or prevented by networks. And what shows sort of see that resurrection as a sign that they were already doing what they were supposed to be doing, and that they just keep making material that's like what they were doing before?
I wonder if viewers are becoming, I don't know, more and more rabid. I mean, now that they have a voice on social media, it seems like the conversation with network executives or about with other fans is much more direct. What's happening to the sort of sense of viewership in the age of multi-platform television?
Well, I think that it goes back a ways, and I think we're seeing it evolving as we see campaigns like this work and as we see other options for network shows that get canceled or even cable shows that get canceled. Years and years ago, Deadwood was famously not picked up after its third season by HBO. And the reaction to that was certainly angry on the part of long-term fans, but there was a kind of just sort of mourning over this. HBO famously promised David Milch the opportunity to wrap up the story in two feature-length films that they would produce on HBO. That never happened, and that the idea of two movies as a way of wrapping up the show has become kind of a running joke, I think, about shows getting canceled. But back then, there wasn't a Hulu or a Netflix to pick up Deadwood. Now, I think viewers are both sad and angry, but they also feel like there's actually something that they can do about it. We even see something like Veronica Mars being brought back as a movie, which isn't exactly, you know, resurrecting the television series, but it's a moment where fans sort of see the possibility of these other platforms as a way of not having to let go of shows that they feel a great personal connection with.
Philip Maciek, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Philip Maciek, he's assistant professor of English and film studies at LSU, and he writes the Dear Television column for the LA Review of Books.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a busy couple of weeks for the Supreme Court, and with most of the attention focused on the historic same-sex marriage decision and the court's decision to leave a key provision of the Affordable Care Act intact. Another case with potentially far-reaching implications is getting lost in the shuffle. Ilya Soman is a professor at the George Mason University School of Law and a contributor to the Washington Post blog The Volokh Conspiracy. That's where we found his recent post, Property Owners Prevail in Raisin Takings Case. Ilya, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me.
So although rooted in the Constitution, this case does begin with a federal program that's been around since the 1930s. Tell us a little bit about the U.S. Department of Agriculture's California Raisin Marketing Order.
Well, the law authorizing the program has been around since the 1930s. The program itself dates back to 1949. And basically, the purpose of this program is to raise raisin prices to benefit raisin producers at the expense of people like you and me, most likely consumers of raisins. Essentially, what they say is that if production of raisins in a given year rises beyond a certain point, then the producers and handlers of the raisins have to turn over a certain proportion of the crop to the federal government, which then disposes of them in such a way that they won't enter the U.S. market for raisins, therefore keeping the prices high.
The plaintiffs in the case are the Horns. They are grape farmers from California. Now, what was their case against the Department of Agriculture?
The basic idea is very simple. The Fifth Amendment says that if the government takes private property, they must pay just compensation for it. And in this case, the government was taking the raisins that had previously belonged to the Horns and other raisin producers, and raisins pretty clearly are a form of property, and it seems like all property of that kind would be covered by the Fifth Amendment.
So this was not a case where a number of raisin producers banded together. The Horns really stuck their necks out a bit. Now, why are other farmers not in favor of this or not willing to go that far?
So I'm not an expert on the raisin industry, but as I understand it, there are some of the raisin farmers who clearly believe they are net beneficiaries of this program. They may lose some raisins, but they benefit more from having higher raisin prices. The Horns calculate that if they could sell more raisins, even at lower prices, they would ultimately be better off. So as in many industries, attempts to form a cartel can be undermined when there are differing interests as between different market participants. But here you have, in effect, the government serving as the enforcer of a cartel. If a private organization tried to create a cartel like this on its own and function as an enforcer, the government would almost certainly go after them under the antitrust laws. But because the government is itself the one that's doing it, the situation is legally different, though economically almost exactly the same.
But the government does not pay for these raisins. They take them.
That's right. It is the case that in some cases when they sell them, sometimes the raisin producers get some share of the profits, but they certainly don't get the full market value of the raisins, the level of compensation that would be required under the Fifth Amendment.
Now, I mean, this was kind of a surprise to me that the U.S. government steps in to control prices of a commodity, in effect, enforce a cartel. Any other products fall under this kind of policy?
There are a number of other agricultural products that have similar cartels. More broadly, this is a holdover of an idea that was very popular during the New Deal. In the 1930s, many people, including many people in the Roosevelt administration, believed that the Great Depression was caused in part, at least, by overproduction, and they somehow believed that if you limit production, then maybe the economy would right itself and things would get better, and certainly producers would be better off. Virtually no serious economist believes this sort of theory today, but some programs established in that era continue to exist to this day because they benefit well-organized special interest groups, and most of the general public, at least until this raisins case, didn't even realize that these programs exist and that the raisins that you buy in the supermarket are sometimes more expensive as a result of the program.
So is this the first significant challenge to that program since the Roosevelt era?
It's certainly the first under the Takings Clause. I don't know enough to say that there's never been any challenge of any other kind.
Well, the court did rule 8-1 in favor of the Horns. Now, what is the key takeaway from this decision?
So the key takeaway is that this is, in fact, a taking. The government had argued that it's not really a taking for two reasons. One is they said, well, this involves personal property as opposed to real property. Real property is property in land. Personal property is property in most physical objects, including raisins. And they said, well, the Takings Clause doesn't really protect personal property as much as it protects real property. The lower court bought this very dangerous argument, but 8 out of 9 Supreme Court justices did not, and it's fortunate that they didn't. The second argument that the federal government really relied on heavily is they said, well, these people, they shouldn't be complaining. They actually benefit from the taking. As Justice Scalia put it, they're actually ingrates. But the fact that they benefit in some ways doesn't mean a taking didn't occur in the first place. At most, it might mean that the benefit that they got should affect the level of compensation they get. So if either of these two arguments had prevailed, the government would have had a free hand to endanger a lot of property rights that go well beyond raisins. Certainly that would have happened if the court had said that personal property generally gets less protection under the Constitution, and if they had said that there's no taking so long as the owner of the property benefits in some way, then the door would have been opened to government in effect saying, well, we're going to take your house away from you, but it's not a real taking because we'll give you, say, 5 or 10% of the proceeds from the sale of the house.
So victory for the Horns. Who else stands to gain from or who is celebrating this victory?
I think people who care about constitutional property rights generally are celebrating, even if you don't care very much about raisins. You have reason perhaps to be concerned about the security of property rights generally. Also, if this decision ends up eliminating this raisin cartel and other similar ones, then consumers have reason to celebrate that the prices of their food will be lower. And that might not matter too much to people in my income class who can easily afford slightly higher or even significantly higher prices for food. But for lower and middle class people, it'll matter more.
Will we likely see a rapid decline in raisin prices as a result?
I don't know about a rapid decline. I think if this program does end as a result, and it's not completely certain that it will, but if it does, then at least in some years there will be significantly lower raisin prices because this program only kicks in certain years where raisin production is unusually high. So in those years, consumers will at least benefit from lower prices. It's also possible that in the long run, this will incentivize higher levels of raisin production because I would think, I'm not an expert in this industry, but I would think that if producers know that if they produce more than a certain amount, that they're likely to just lose those additional raisins, that probably reduces their incentives to produce more in the first place.
Looking at the composition of the Roberts Court, what's the legacy of a case like this, which has dealt with some, you know, citizens versus government cases?
So I think property rights questions sometimes divide judges along right-left lines, with conservatives and libertarians saying we want stronger protection for property rights, liberals being skeptical of it. Here, because you have an 8-to-1 decision, this is actually one of a series of decisions over the last several years where the court has actually ruled in a much more unified way that in some areas the government is not sufficiently respecting people's property rights under the takings clause. Some of that simply involves relatively extreme actions and positions taken by the federal government in various cases that even the liberal justices could not accept. But some of it also, I think, involves a new seriousness by the Supreme Court generally about protecting property rights after an era when, for a long time, property rights had essentially a kind of second-class status in the court's jurisprudence.
Well, Ilya Soman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ilya Soman, he's a professor at the George Mason University School of Law. He's also a contributor to the Washington Post blog, The Volokh Conspiracy. He's the author of the 2015 book, The Grasping Hand, Kelo versus the City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain. You'll find a link to read his post from the Washington Post's Volokh Conspiracy blog on the raisin takings case and much more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Recording devices are strictly prohibited inside the Supreme Court, which means that broadcast interns have to run, literally run, hard copies of the verdicts from the courtroom to the scrum of reporters and cameras waiting outside. When the Supreme Court handed down its landmark decision on same-sex marriage, interns in sensible running shoes raced each other in an attempt to deliver the news first. But in the early days of our nation's history, verdicts were delivered in a much different way. Catherine Moore from the podcast Backstory with the American History Guys brings us the story.
Imagine you're having a property dispute with one of your neighbors. He sues you. Next thing you know, a Supreme Court justice shows up in town to hand down the verdict. This might sound crazy, but in the early republic, it happened. The Judiciary Act of 1789 divided the country into three circuits, but it didn't assign any judges to those seats. The idea was that the Supreme Court justices themselves would spend about half the year traveling all over the country holding court. It was called circuit riding. In the words of one senator, the circuit riding system carried law to the people's homes, courts to their doors. Sounds like democracy, right? Maybe, but the justices hated it. 2 years after they started riding circuit, they wrote to George Washington pleading for an end to the practice.
We find the burdens laid upon us so excessive that we cannot forbear representing them in strong and explicit terms. We cannot reconcile ourselves to the idea of existing in exile from our families and of being subjected to a kind of life on which we cannot reflect without experiencing sensations and emotions more easy to conceive than proper for us to express.
Put yourself in their shoes, traveling thousands of miles a year on rugged roads, far from your family, exposed to disease, and sleeping in wretched accommodations. One senator remarked that justices required less the learning of a judge than the agility of a postboy. Circuit riding made the justices sick, literally. William Cushing's carriage flipped, and he later died from the injury. John Blair had chronic headaches. Samuel Chase fell into a frozen river and almost drowned. James Iredell almost drowned in a Georgia flood. And that was after his leg was run over by a carriage. Iredell might have had it the worst. He was assigned to the Southern Circuit, the wildest of them all. He died at 48, having spent himself on years of circuit riding. So why torture the poor guys? Well, the easy answer is that purse strings were tight and this saved money. But the more interesting explanation is that circuit riders would help bind the new nation, both through their rulings and through their work as proselytizers of the federal government.
It was the only institution where normal people, regular folk, could actually have contact with a federal official.
That's Mava Marcus, editor of the 8-volume documentary history of the Supreme Court, 1789 to 1800.
The justices knew they were carrying a weight. They had to impress upon the citizenry that this government was doing the right thing and everybody should be involved.
You have to understand, in the 1790s, government was strongest at the state level, and the success of the new nation was not a foregone conclusion. With so much at stake, making a Supreme Court nomination was a little like selecting an ambassador.
Washington chose as justices men who had supported the Revolution, had supported the Constitution, had experience as statesmen. He was not particularly interested in legal scholars.
Peter Onuf, a historian and co-host of the radio program Backstory, puts it this way.
In a way, we think now about Washington, you know, the vortex of power sucking everybody into the Beltway. In those days, if the federal government was going to exist, it had to work in the opposite direction. It had to have a presence out there in the rest of the country.
But as the nation matured, the power of the federal government and the Supreme Court became increasingly consolidated and self-evident. The role of circuit riders as Federalist schoolmasters gradually diminished. The country was also expanding. More circuits were added, and faced with a ballooning docket, it became impossible to keep up. The Judiciary Act of 1891 essentially put an end to circuit riding by creating circuit courts of appeals with their own set of judges. But it wasn't until 1911 that Congress abolished the old circuit system altogether. And finally, the long-suffering justices got what they had wanted for over 100 years. The old system didn't disappear entirely, though. After they retire, Supreme Court justices can still travel all over the place, serving as federal appeals court judges anywhere in the country. Only 8 have availed themselves of the opportunity.
Catherine Moore there from the podcast Backstory with the American History Guys. If you'd like to see this year's Running of the Interns, you find a link to watch it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today, and there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast, or you can sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please write a review and pass it along or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.